And turn to Genesis again for our Sunday evening sermon series on Noah and the flood. This is the fifth sermon. And we're in Genesis 8. And we'll read the first 19 verses here in a moment. All right, let's listen to God's holy word then, Genesis 8, verses 1 through 19. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed, the rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the water had abated. Seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth a dove, and she did not return to him any more. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark, and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, "Go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by families from the ark. God's word. Now, this is a well-known story, like we've been talking about. And as I was looking at it again this week, there's another thing that I want to point out, and I was going to do this in the sermon, but I just ran out of time and ran out of space. So just remember the story that we read, and I'm going to, you can turn there if you want, but I'm going to read 1 Peter 3, verse 20. 1 Peter 3, verse 20 and following, it corresponds to what we just read. So listen to this in 1 Peter 3:20. God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience towards God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand, with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. So, all that to say, Peter mentions this story in 1 Peter 3, verse 20, and I was going to include it in the sermon tonight, but I just ran out of room and space. But the good news is that I did preach on this text in 1 Peter not too long ago. So if you want to read more about, or you want to learn more about that, you can listen to the sermon series I gave in 1 Peter, and it was last July. So this text does point to Jesus, and we learned that a couple of months ago or some months ago. But back to the story then. So again, all that to say, go look at 1 Peter 3, verse 20 and how the flood points to Jesus and baptism. There are other things we're going to look at tonight, though. We have seen in this story of the flood a crescendo. Remember, if you look at the literary features of the story, the water rises and rises and rises, and there's repetition to show this crescendo when the water was prevailing over the face of the earth in the end of chapter 7. The flood was escalating, and the text itself showed the escalation of the flood in how it was written. But now, we're seeing a major change in the story. In Genesis 8, verse 1, it says, God remembered Noah. And so we're going to look at this flood story tonight and how the flood water decreased off the face of the earth. And my three-point outline tonight is, it's probably one of the most compelling and creative outlines I've ever had. So if you have a pencil, you're going to want to write this one down. So my first point is going. My second point is going. And my third point is gone. So the text does show us that order. It repeats over and over how the floodwaters continually receded off the face of the earth until the land was dry. So let's look at this first part of the story in verses 1 through 5. The ESV here has the paragraph breaks aren't, I don't always agree with them, but in chapter 8, I like the paragraph breaks, and that's kind of the points in my text that we'll be looking at, or in the sermon that we'll be looking at. So again, the story starts, or it continues here, and it says, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. Now, we're going to come back at the end of the sermon and talk about how God remembered Noah. So mark that. That's a very significant phrase. We're going to look at it later. But here, then, it says that God caused a wind to pass over the earth, is how you could translate it, and the waters decreased. Now, that word for wind in the Old Testament is a very complex word sometimes because it can mean spirit or it can mean breath. Now, here we would translate it wind, but it's not just a regular wind, you know, like that's going to happen this week, probably. But it's a miraculous kind of wind because this wind caused the floodwaters to go down, and it's impossible for us to explain this. If there was so much wind that the floodwaters started to go down, how did the ark not get destroyed in the big waters that the waves that the wind would create? So it's some kind of a miraculous wind. And there's the wind of God elsewhere in Old Testament stories, and it's the same word for wind. What are some other stories in the Old Testament that have the wind of God? Well, in Exodus, actually, in Genesis, it talks about, it's not the translation for wind, but spirit. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So it's the same Hebrew word, but a different translation. So here we have that the wind, the Spirit over the waters again. But later, do you remember how the waters of the Red Sea were split? By a wind of God. Or in Psalm 78, it says, God caused an east wind to blow in the heavens to split the sea. Now remember how the quail came to the people in the wilderness? A wind brought the quail. Or remember that big storm in Jonah's story? A great wind brought that storm. So there are different kinds of these stories in the Old Testament where God sends a wind and something amazing happens. This is not just any wind. This is a special wind from God. So the wind passes over the face of the water that God, God caused this wind to come. And look what happens. Two things in verse 2. So, well, actually, the first thing in verse 1, the waters subsided, they started going down. And then it says in verse 2, the fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. Now, remember we talked about that last week. What are these? The fountains of the deep? We're not sure. And the windows of heaven, we're not 100% sure. But whatever what they were, after God sent this wind, they closed. They were done. They shut. And it says in verse 2 that the rain from the heavens was held back. So no more rain. The rain had ended, and the windows above were closed, and the fountains beneath were closed, and the water's going down. Now, it's interesting. It keeps kind of echoing these same things. Look in verse 3. It says, the waters receded from the earth continually. And it's very interesting in the Hebrew here. It's something like, the waters on the earth returned and went and returned. So they're going and going down, and they're going back to wherever they came from, something like that. The NIV has a good translation. The water receded steadily from the earth. So far, this is kind of what we understand from the story, right? God remembered Noah and the animals in the ark. He sends this miraculous wind. The waters are going down. The windows above are shut. The fountains beneath are shut. The rain stops, and the water keeps going down. So this is the exact opposite of what happened earlier in the story. Earlier, everything was coming up. Now it's going back down. Now, it's interesting in verse 3, it says, at the end of 150 days, the water had abated. That means, you know, it kept going down. And then verse 4, it says, in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest. Now, in the original, the ark came to rest is in the beginning of the sentence. So the ark came to rest in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month. You could even translate it, the ark rested in the seventh month. There's a word play here. You kind of see what's going on here. There's this word play. And the word rest actually sounds like Noah in Hebrew. I think I mentioned that before. So this is, you know, a rough way to say it, but it's like the ark Noah'd in the seventh month. The ark rested. It's a word play on the name Noah. And this was 150 days after the flood had started, in the second month on the 17th day. So we do have a rough timeline here. So the ark was floating on the raging waters for so long. From the second month of Noah's 600th year, then there was 40 days of rain. Then there were 110 days where there was so much water on the earth that it was covered. But the waters must have started going down before that 150th day. Because on the 150th day, the ark came to rest on a mountain. Now, it's okay. Remember, I always talk about biblical imagination. We don't want to speculate, but it's okay just to think about what was going on in the people's mind. Again, we don't know for sure. What were Noah and his family thinking? The ark stopped. This is different. What happened? Is it over? Why did we stop? They were in 150 days in this raging flood, and suddenly the boat came to a stop, and I doubt they knew where they were. Think of all the different questions they would have, that I would have. But what mountain did it stop on? Well, it doesn't say mountain singular, but look in the end of verse 4. It says, on the mountains of Ararat. It's not precise, is it? Now, Ararat, by the way, is a region north of Assyria. And Ararat is mentioned elsewhere in the Bible, like in 2 Kings and in the Prophets. It's a land way north, and there must have been mountains there. And one of those mountains in that land of Ararat is where the ark came to rest. And we don't know exactly where this is. And actually, in my opinion, it's not really worth the time and money and energy to go try to dig up the ark or try to find out which mountain it's on and find pieces of it. It was thousands of years ago. We don't know exactly where it is, and at the end of the day, we don't need it to prove the historicity of the Old Testament. We have other archaeological things that will help us prove the historicity of the Old Testament. And remember the New Testament phrase, we walk by faith and not by sight. So if we never find the ark, that's okay. I mean, we still believe it's a true biblical story. But there is a good question here. Why didn't the ark land on top of another mountain halfway across the world? Why did the ark land in the rough area of what we call Palestine? God's providence, I guess, is the best answer that we can come up with. But it's a mysterious providence that the ark came to rest somewhere in the region of Palestine and not in what we call South America or something like that. But the story goes on in verse 5. It says, the waters continue to abate. Abate means, you know, go down until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains appeared or were seen. So if the months were 30 days long, it meant that the ark stayed on the mountaintop for probably 44 days. Again, these numbers are not perfectly easy to figure out. There's a lot of calendar dates here. Depends on how long their months were and such, probably 30 days. But the ark was on top of one of the mountains in Ararat for around 44 days. And so that's the first part of the story. It's kind of what we've heard before. But let's look what happens then at verse 6. Moving on, it's going down still, the second part here. It says in verse 6, at the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made. Okay, so there's 40 days of rain earlier. Time passed. Now there's 40 days of waiting when the rain was over and the waters were going down. And the word for window is the first time it's mentioned here in the story. It's not the same for the wind, not the same word for the windows of heaven were opened. But this is a window of the ark, which we learn about here for the first time. We read earlier in chapter 6 that there was some kind of a roof or skylight for the ark and something about a cubit above it all. But there was at least one window, and Noah could reach up to open it. And what does he do with this window? Well, he sends out a raven, or you could think of a crow. We know what a crow is. Now, that's interesting. A raven is an unclean animal. You can read about that, or a crow in Leviticus 11. They're unclean animals. And interestingly, God commanded, what kind of birds did God command to feed Elijah? A raven. But why a crow or a raven? Well, we could do allegory. You know what allegory is? It's like this. Well, the raven symbolizes false teachers who go to and fro to spread unclean teachings. But we're not going to allegorize. Why a raven? Well, if you would ask an old Jewish rabbi long ago, they would say that Noah sent out a raven because, number one, you can't eat it. Number two, you can't sacrifice it, so it's expendable. Send it out. But other commentaries say it's probably just because a raven or a crow is one of the stronger birds, and it could go for quite some time. And it is interesting, too, another thing that is interesting. In verse 7, it says, it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. And it's not really clear what it means that he went to and from until the waters dried up. Did he come back to the ark and land on top of it, or did he fly around there and land on driftwood? We don't know, but he was out to and from until the waters dried up. Now, then Noah sends another bird, and this one we're familiar with. In verse 8, he sends a dove to see if the waters had come down or subsided from the face of the ground. Now, what's the significance of a dove? You can think of a pigeon. We know what a pigeon is. It's something like that. And this animal is a clean animal, like Leviticus talks about, and an animal that you could sacrifice. So the dove goes, but it says the dove didn't find a place to rest her foot, so she returned to Noah and to the ark. Now there's that word rest again. I know here in verse 9 it says the dove found no place to set her foot, but you could translate that rest. That's the word for rest. And so there's that word play coming up again. The ark rested, but the dove couldn't rest, so the dove came back to Noah. And that's that word that sounds like Noah. So Noah sent the dove out. The dove didn't find a place to Noah and came back to Noah. But there's a fascinating detail in verse 9. At the end, why that detail? So he put out his hand and took her, that's the dove. Noah puts out his hand and take the dove and brought her into the ark with him. Usually you don't get that detail in narratives like that. Now, I would say, for one thing, that it shows Noah's importance. Remember, he's kind of like another Adam. Earlier the animals were coming to him. He has dominion, kind of like another Adam. And commentaries make a good point on this one too. Remember in verse 1, it said, the Lord remembered Noah and the animals. And so Noah is being like God, godly, in being kind and caring to the animals. So Proverbs 12 says, a righteous man has regard for the life of his animal. So there is a reason for the detail in this text. It's not a throwaway line. Why does it say that Noah did this so gently with the dove? It's definitely not a main point of the story, but it is worth mentioning that God cared for the animals. He remembered them. Noah showed some kind of tenderness towards them, and we should too in some ways. There's a balance for us when we think about us and animals in this world. Of course, we don't want to idolize animals. We don't want to idolize our pets. But way on the other side, we don't want to brutalize animals in a terribly evil way. So right in the middle, there's a balance of stewardship and dominion over animals. So there's something to think about why Noah was so tender to this dove. But the dove is in the ark because the dove found no place to rest her foot. And then in verse 10, it says, Noah waits another 7 days and sends the dove again out of the ark. And this time, it says, it came back to him in the evening. So the dove is flying out there. And that night, the dove comes back. In verse 11, and there's this important word, behold. So that word is like, look. In her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. Now, we know what an olive tree is, even though we've probably not seen one. It's not uncommon for us to hear about an olive tree. It was a common tree back then. And Martin Luther makes this great statement. He says, a dove is not smart enough to pick an olive leaf and bring it back to the ark to Noah. God ordained these events. And Noah knew, though. This was maybe another little mini miracle that the dove grabbed an olive leaf and came back. And it says that Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. The waters were growing small is a way to translate that. Now, it doesn't mean that the water was gone from everywhere, but it means things are growing. Because the dove didn't get a dead leaf that was floating on the top of the water, but one that was alive, freshly picked. Now, we're not sure exactly about all the time period in the days, but it could be that there had been some land for 40 or more days before this point, if you do the math and look at the calendar date. So it's quite possible, and it was happened, that things were growing, at least a little shoot of an olive tree, and the dove brings back the leaf. But Noah, so he knows things are growing out there, but he doesn't bust open the doors and say, let's leave. What does he do? Verse 12 says he waited another 7 days and sent forth a dove. This time the dove didn't come back anymore. So Noah knows that the world is drying up. And he knows that the dove was gone, so the dove found a place to stop and rest. And the raven's gone. But again, him and his family didn't go out yet. He knows, but he's still waiting. They didn't follow the dove and just, you know, like I say, go out the door and not wait. But he still waited. Well, that's because he hadn't heard from God. Let's look at the last part of the story in verse 13. The waters are gone. It says, in the 601st year, that's, by the way, 601st year of Noah's life. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. Now, not everywhere. It doesn't mean that every piece or every, you know, puddle and lake of water was dried up in the world, but the floodwaters were gone. And it's important to notice the date there. It says in the first month, in the first day of the month. It's a time of firsts. It's you know, like day one. It's kind of a new creation, a new year, a day of firsts, a new epoch, a new era. In fact, one church father, Clement, said it's a new birth to the world. First day, first month. And at that point, Noah takes the initiative. It says he removed the covering of the ark and look, and he looked, he saw. And then it says again, behold, the face of the ground was dry. There's that word again, behold, look. He opened whatever this covering of the ark was. It's the same, actually, word for the covering of the tabernacle. He opens the covering, and he can see that the land was dry. Behold, a miracle. See, I made all things new, like Jesus would say later. Now, if you stop and think here about this renewed world, it does. We can think about the renewed world at the end of time. And in fact, Peter makes this connection in 2 Peter 3. He says he talks about the flood way back in Noah's day. It flooded the world and the world perished. And Peter says that similarly, a day is coming where the heavens are going to pass away and be dissolved. So Peter says, for now, live godly and holy lives, because according to God's promise, we're waiting for a new heavens and earth in which righteousness dwells. So you see that the newness in Noah's day is a little hint to the newness of all things when Jesus comes and makes all things new. So we got a little hint there. And you can think about Revelation 21. Meditate on this week. It says in Revelation 21, John said, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. So we get a hint of the new creation here. And the story goes on, though. In verse 14, it says, in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Now, again, if you count, commentaries differ, scholars differ on this, but if you count, it was probably right around 1 year and 11 days that Noah was in the ark. Just over 1 year, you can think. And earlier, remember what happened earlier in the flood? It seemed like the waters of creation were coming back together and creation was coming undone. But now everything is going back to where it belongs and there's division and this new kind of creation. Now it's very different or interesting once again. In verse 13 and verse 14, it repeats kind of the same thing. It says the face of the ground was dry in verse 13. And the end of verse 14, the earth had dried out. So there's these interesting textual things that repeat to show us that it's gradually drying. And now it's dry enough for Noah to be able to come out when God tells him. Now again, there's so many questions we can't answer. Where did all this water go? I'm not a scientist, I'll admit that right away, but I don't think that all the water could be absorbed into the cracks and fissures of the earth. And the wind can only dry up so much. So once again here, even if you can't answer this scientifically, we're bumping up against mystery and the sovereignty of God. We don't know exactly how the earth became dry from after the flood, but God did it in his sovereignty. And finally, then Noah gets this command. God speaks again in verse 15. It says, then God said to Noah, he says, get out from the ark, you, your wife, your sons, and your sons' wives with you. So before the flood, Noah hears the words from God and says, make an ark and get in the ark, right? And then over a year later, God speaks again, get out of the ark. We don't know if God spoke to Noah between, you know, those two times, when he got in and when he got out. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But this would be an easy command to obey. Sure, I'm sick of the ark. I'm never actually going to set foot in the ark again. I'll come out immediately. That's an easy command to obey. The first command, build an ark, that's maybe a little tougher. But here, get out. And bring all the animals with you, God says. The birds and the creeping things, every animal has to come out. And then in verse 17, it says, be fruitful and multiply over the earth. Be fruitful and multiply. And what does that sound like? Genesis 1, 2, and 3, right? The cultural mandate, which we'll talk about more next week. Be fruitful and multiply. And sure enough, Noah obeys. In verse 18, Noah goes out and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. And then it says, all the beasts, creeping things, birds, everything, they went out by families from the ark. And they stepped on dry ground. It doesn't say that in the text, but of course that happened. There was no more flood. And there's no more wicked people. Interesting, we don't know the population density back then, but who knows how many people were, you know, those wicked, terrible, bad people were around Noah when he got on the ark. But they're gone because God judged the wicked in the flood and wiped them out because of their wickedness. And now there's no more evil people, those evil people on the earth. Again, it's hard for us to imagine what Noah and his family were thinking. What would you think? Maybe Noah was thinking, okay, let's not ruin this and start fighting and arguing right away. Now, sadly, we do know how the story goes on. This newness and this goodness doesn't last too long. It just takes Noah and some alcohol and other things after that happen. But for now, the earth is renewed. Now, there's other things to think about. This again, there's so many interesting things to talk about in this text. There's so many things that we could do here, so many questions we could discuss. But I want to go back in our application as we conclude here to that first phrase in verse 8. Chapter 8, verse 1. God remembered Noah. So Noah's in the ark, and it had to have been difficult. It couldn't have been an easy ride on the ark. But God remembered Noah. And that word remembered is very significant in the Old Testament. It's used over 200 times. And it's not just like, remember that 2 plus 2 equals 4. That's just like bare remembering. It's, you know, not like, remember how the Astros stole those signs in the World Series in 2017. Just bare remembering. But this remembering is deeper. It's recalling and acting accordingly. So God remembered Noah, he recalled Noah, and he acted accordingly, and he made the waters go down. So one commentary said that God's remembrance is an act of committed compassion. A great way to put it. God remembered Noah, it's an act of committed compassion. Now, it's not like God might have forgotten Noah. It's not, the text is not hinting that God sometimes forgets his people, but this was written for us to remind us that God remembers us, even during those difficult times in life. And so when you think about these different acts of God's remembering, he remembered Abraham, it says in the Bible. He remembered Rachel. He remembered Israel in Egypt. He remembered Hannah. Psalm 136 says he remembered us in our low condition. So once again, if Noah's family had doubts, if Noah's family was asking him, you know, what are we, are you sure God is going to help us? We've been in this ark a long time and we've really been tossed around. But God remembered Noah. Calvin says, it's great, I'm paraphrasing a little bit. It's not to be questioned that Noah's heart was agitated by the various feelings when he found himself in suspense so long. He may have thought that his life had been prolonged to be more miserable than the rest of mankind. But God remembered Noah. God didn't forget Noah and his family and the animals. And we can think, then we can draw application from this text, and God will not forget us. And God will remember me. We talked about this in Isaiah 49. Remember that maybe a month ago, I don't know. It said in Isaiah 49, can a woman forget her nursing child or a newborn not have compassion on her son? Then God says, even if she would forget, yet I will not forget you. We have that promise from God to his people, God to those who follow Jesus. He will not forget you. That's comforting, isn't it? I have struggles in the faith sometimes. Sometimes I doubt things. When you have difficult times in life, and maybe you're going through a prolonged time of difficulty in your life, think of Noah's prolonged difficulty. It's sometimes easy for us to think, Lord, have you forgotten me? The psalmist actually asks that question. We ask that question because life is hard, and sometimes, you know what, it feels like God has forgotten us because we're still in this miserable condition. But then this text comes out. God remembered Noah. God remembers you. And so again, let me paraphrase Calvin. This is great. He says, when it seems that God has forgotten us, let's learn from this example to rest in the providence of God. And when he does help us, it will tell us he's been mindful of us. Then Calvin goes on and says, if our sinful flesh tempts us to stop trusting in God, don't yield to it. Don't yield to your sinful flesh if it says, don't trust in God anymore, he's forgotten you. When that thought creeps in, that God might have forgotten you, when that thought creeps in, or you think that God is far off, let us meet that thought with this shield, Calvin said. The Lord does not forget his people. The Lord does not forget his people. That's a shield to remember on those days and times, weeks, months, even years, when it feels like God has forgotten you. Pull out the shield. No, the Bible says the Lord remembers his people. And Calvin ends that little thought by saying, in due time, he will help me. In due time, he will help you. So there are, as I've mentioned a lot, there are plenty of unanswered questions in the flood story. A lot of mystery here, and that's good. It's good for us to have mystery in the faith because we don't know all the details of the mighty works of God. There are unanswered questions, but there are certainties in this story. It's not all uncertain. And the one for us to meditate on tonight as we leave is this. The Lord remembers his people. And you can rest in that reality. Amen. Let's pray.